With news of the indictment of a former Speaker of the House, one key term to know is called structuring. From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio. Details are just beginning to unfold about the indictment of Dennis Hastert, the former Speaker of the House, for allegedly lying to the FBI about what may be hush money. Part of this focuses on something that's been a crime for 45 years now, keeping withdrawals and deposits of money small enough so that they don't trigger red flags. It's called structuring, and the U.S. attorney in Chicago alleges that Hastert, after he left office, used structuring to hide payments to somebody to keep quiet about some unspecified misconduct. For more, I want to bring in reporter Tim Fitzsimmons from the Marketplace Washington Bureau. Tim, why does the size of a transaction matter?
Well, initially, the Bank Secrecy Act was about catching criminals, money launderers, tax evaders, drug traffickers, but it's been modified. Indeed, it was modified by the Patriot Act, whose passage Hastert himself oversaw in 2001. The idea is that if someone is withdrawing or depositing huge sums in cash, there may be some illicit activity going on behind the scenes. It's called structuring. So what structuring means is arranging your withdrawals or deposits to avoid setting off those alarm bells. Those alarm bells would force your bank to say, hey, IRS, some guy is depositing or withdrawing briefcases full of cash. You might want to check this out. But the thing is, these days, banks can report sums under $10,000 if they think they are suspicious.
So what do we know at this point about what Mr. Hastert may have done?
Well, the indictment says Hastert agreed to pay Individual A $3.5 million to keep him or her quiet about past misconduct. We don't know yet what that was. Hastert started by making $50,000 withdrawals that automatically set off the alarm bells built into the Bank Secrecy Act because the withdrawals were above $10,000. So he got interviewed by bank officials, and he allegedly told them that he didn't trust the banking system and he was holding the money in cash for himself. But then after that point, Hastert began to withdraw money in increments under $10,000. In total, he only got about $1.7 million of the $3.5 million he allegedly promised his alleged blackmailer.
If indeed that's what it was. Tim Fitzsimmons, thank you very much. Now, it's been getting easier to jump into the business of pilotless aircraft. A company called DJI, which makes drone aircraft, and a software firm that makes software for drones, are each putting together separate pools of venture capital to help kickstart entrepreneurs that want to start up drone companies of their own. Stan Alcorn reports that it seems that something is in the air.
In the world of venture capital, you don't find a lot of funds focused on a single specific gadget. So when two are announced on the same day, that's got to be coordinated, right?
No, we definitely did not coordinate it. So pretty significant coincidence.
Jonathan Downey of Airware and the just-launched Commercial Drone Fund says the significance of the coincidence is that to really thrive, a drone company like his needs a more thriving drone industry.
It's going to need different sensors. It's going to need different software algorithms. And no one company is going to build all of that.
And investors are increasingly willing to fund this drone-filled future, putting up as much money so far this year as the previous five combined, according to data from CB Insights.
Why the big jump?
Mariana Sanko is an analyst at Lux Research.
One, the astronomical sales of consumer drones.
And two, regulation that makes commercial use for agriculture, construction, and yes, even delivering packages look increasingly likely. I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
School year is nearing an end, and administrators are turning their attention to resources for the next academic year. How many students, teachers, classroom aides, both human and, keyword here, digital? Marketplace's Adrian Hill is here with some tales about how this can play out in the real world. Good morning, Adrian.
Good morning, David.
So, one child, one-to-one with a digital device. It can work, or?
Or it can go terribly wrong, as it did here in Los Angeles. You know, the city here had big plans to give every kid an iPad, but there were problems with the deal with Apple. There were problems with the education company providing the software. You name it. LA Unified here has backed off of that plan. It's asking Apple and Pearson, the curriculum company, for some of its money back. And the district is under federal investigation. But usually things aren't quite that dramatic.
If indeed there's a more functional system and a teacher ends up with students, each of whom have a device all their own, What does that mean?
Some of it depends on how much the teacher actually embraces that device. Schools have really realized they have to help train teachers on these devices because a device in the hand of every student means that a teacher starts teaching in a whole new way. You know, I talked to a longtime history teacher who told me that for years he just drilled kids on facts out of textbooks. Now his kids are doing more complicated work, and the history teacher, who could retire technically in 3 years, wants to stick around for 10 more because he likes his job so much more. Other teachers, though, like it less. They worry about computers replacing teachers. They're overwhelmed by the data from all this education technology. It can just be hard to make heads or tails of all this stuff.
But what about for students?
Well, the students I've talked to over the year who've had access to their own device, for the most part, are happy with the technology. I will say they seem distracted by it at times. I was recently doing an interview with some kids who were emailing each other during the interview about the interview. I could see it over their shoulder. But again, they feel like they're learning new, interesting things. I think overall, these changes are, as they're happening in more and more districts around the country, are going to be things that we as parents, as educators, and students are going to be talking about. Sort of what happens if you give a kid a laptop?
All right, remember that phrase, if you give a kid a laptop. Adrian and the Learning Curve team have created an animated video with that name. It's on our website, marketplace.org. I assume it's ponderous.
It's light and fun. You'll love it.
All right. Adrian, thank you.
Thanks, David.
And before we go, things have been especially volatile this week on the high-flying Shanghai Stock Exchange. At one point today, the key index there was down 4%. It then recovered. Our senior producer is Nicole Childers. Our online digital producer, Tobin Lowe. I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.